Howdy, Greg Swan here. I am coming to you from selfadoration.com. I wrote a book called Man Alive, a survival manual for the human mind. And I make these spreecasts in order to talk about that book, to talk about the ideas in that book, and we're definitely going to do that today because... it's on my mind. Blues. I love it. I just love the sound of it. This is the 145 blues in open E. If you know anything about the guitar, you know this is like the easiest thing there is to do on the guitar. So I'm not a, do not ever want to represent myself as being in some way proficient on the guitar because I'm not, but I have a lot of fun with it. I enjoy it, and it enables me to talk in a civilized fashion and to provide a little soundtrack to my conversation. It helps me think. I don't know if it helps you or not. It may distract you, and that's the risk you take for participating in this. I have been talking all this week at freetheanimal.com. Richard Nicolai runs freetheanimal.com, which is a paleo living weblog, and Richard has been graciously, wonderfully, God bless him, has been publishing chapters of Man Alive. Man Alive is a free book, and so the fact that Richard is publishing chapters is not harming my income in any way at all, because the book is available for free. You can find it at selfadoration.com. You can read the whole thing, and I recommend it. This is the reason that I made it available, the reason I'm making it free, the reason I'm doing everything I can think of to promote it is because I want you to read it. It is a survival manual. It is a culture. As far as I'm concerned, the world at large is at war with your mind. And Man Alive is a very brief strategic defense manual for your mind. And that's what I want to talk about today. The chapter that's up at freetheanimal.com this week is chapter two of the book, which is The Nature of Your Nature. And basically it's a discussion or an introduction to the ontology of human nature. Ontology is the branch of philosophy that is concerned with the nature of real things. And chapter two is the introduction to a discussion of the nature of mind, how your mind really works, and how the culture, modern philosophy in particular, but philosophy, theology, academia, government, are all at war with your mind and are doing everything they can to undermine your mental functioning in order to turn you into a slave. That's the purpose of it. And chapter two concludes with a discussion of very common arguments about human nature, bogus arguments, in my opinion, fallacious arguments about human nature. There are three of them that I cite that I see all the time, and every once in a while, especially at SplendorQuest.com, which is another site that I run, every once in a while I will highlight these arguments when they show up on the internet because they're so common and they're ubiquitous, and they're completely bogus. But if you're not careful, you can be swayed by them. You can be sucked in by them because they can be very cloyingly persuasive. I mean, it has the mental science. Science proves. Sometime this weekend, I will put up a link to a very thoroughgoing, in my opinion, very thoroughgoing debunking of the tactics, the techniques of modern academic science. And I'm not anti-science. This is one of those things that I constantly have to defend myself against. I'm not anti-science. To the contrary, I am very much pro-science. What I am is anti-deception. And knowingly or unknowingly, many professional intellectuals are now in the deception business. They're in the business of deceiving you, about your mind, about your nature, about your potency, about your capabilities, about what you can do with your life. And the overarching theme of Man Alive is to help you regain control of your mind, regain control of your faculties, and therefore regain control of your life against all of the many committed enemies of your sovereignty. So the three claims, the three bogus claims that I cite at the end of chapter two are, we now know we know nothing, which often... Well, there are two forms that this claim takes. Number one, your mind is completely impotent to apprehend the world outside of itself, that your mind is a Your mind is a defective computer, in other words. Your mind is a computer that's crashed. That's one form that the argument will take, that you know, perception is illusory or perception is erroneous, perception is deceiving, or that your interior mental functioning, your reasoning is inherently invalid, that your mind is unreliable. That's one form that the argument takes. The other form is that the universe outside your mind, the world outside your mind, is so chaotic that you cannot possibly comprehend it. And this is since the mid-1970s or so, this is one of the arguments that comes out of theoretical physics again and again and again. It used to be pretty much quantum mechanics, quantum physics that made this argument that the evidence that we discover of subatomic physics is so chaotic that it implies that everything else is chaotic also. Lately, we're hearing it all in physics in the form of M theory, string theory, which I have derided in the past. I've made fun of it in the past, and I make fun of it in Chapter 8 of Man Alive because I just think it's completely ridiculous. The claim is that there are 17 dimensions, 26 dimensions, N dimensions, you name it, and that there are 10 to the 500th power universes, or as many as 10 to the 500th power universes. Universe means all there is. That's what it means. It means one turning in Latin, univerto. But the universe is all that there is. And to say that there is more than one universe is to say there's more than one all that there is, and that doesn't really make any sense logically, but that's a sayability problem. The next problem, of course, is that whether you say that there are two universes or 10 to the 500th or some number in between, the next thing that any rational person, anyone who is schooled in the scientific method as we learned it from Francis Bacon, would say, okay, so produce evidence from one of these others. And of course, that's not possible. And whether or not this is a useful argument in the laboratory, whether or not this is a useful argument on the whiteboard for purposes of making equations work out, I really don't care. Practically speaking, it's a completely useless argument, but it's one that you will hear all the time, and it will be presented with such authority, with such confidence, such supercilious smugness that we associate with academia, that you can easily be sucked in by, because you won't want to challenge these people. They're so much better at math than you are. How could you dare challenge them? And if you do challenge them, then you're exposing yourself as an ignoramus. No, this is not a tenable argument. Whatever practical purpose it has in the laboratory or in the classroom, it has no practical purpose in real life, and there's no reason to attend to it. So anyway, that's the first of the three. The second, I summarize it as, your good behavior is not to your credit, but at least your bad behavior is not your fault. And this is determinism in all its forms. And I've been talking over the past week or so about watchwork determinism, the idea of Newtonian physics, that the entire universe is a watchwork, and that each observed effect is necessarily caused by some preceding cause, which in turn is the effect of an immediately preceding cause, et cetera, going back ad infinitum, going back to the birth of the universe, which implies that this video, me waving my hand in front of the camera, strumming the guitar, that all of those things were unavoidable, causally unavoidable from the birth of the universe. And that's a completely ridiculous argument. But there are all kinds of other arguments of determinism, behavioral determinism, peer pressure. I left this out of the book. I realized it today that this is one of the causes. The peer pressure caused him to do that. No, it didn't. His economic circumstances. He was born into poverty. The excuses that we made for the 9/11 bombers, those were all determinist arguments. Fat is not a choice. That's one that we'll hear all the time because the United States is crawling with fat people, including me. I'm one of them. That human behavior is not chosen. The reason that there are so many of these arguments is because they're just a big gang up, a big pile up on the idea of free will. The only contrary to any one of these determinist arguments, and there are an infinite number of them. There's no limit to the number of determinist arguments you can make, because all you have to do is negate free will. We understand free will. We know that each one of us is guided by our own internal motivation. We certainly have no problem holding other people accountable for their choices. We may want to make excuses for our own behavior, and we may want to make excuses for other people's behavior if we like them and we want to befriend them. But when we're unhappy that somebody else took our parking space, or somebody else broke our window with a baseball, or somebody else said something mean about us, or whatever, we're not at all shy about holding those people accountable to their behavior. The third one of these arguments is that I call it the dancing bear fallacy. Dancing bears are just like us. And again, it takes two forms. There are two ways you can do this. Number one, you can say that animals, dolphins or monkeys or some other animal, some pet animal that you want to promote, is just as smart as a human being. Look at this. That monkey memorized three letters of the alphabet. That monkey has a vocabulary of 250 words. Can you believe it? These dolphins can solve really simple math problems, whatever it is. This horse can do math. People have trained horses to do math. At the Tropicana Hotel in Las Vegas, I don't know if they still have it or not, for the longest time they had a trained chicken who could play tic-tac-toe. And actually, the algorithms for playing tic-tac-toe perfectly are very easily documented. It's really easy. I can play you tic-tac-toe and never lose, which means that I will always win or tie. I will never lose. And the fact that that is so easy to do algorithmically means that it's easy, for instance, to write computer software to do it. And in the same respect, it's really easy to train an animal to do it. So, you know, training an animal to never lose a tic-tac-toe, that's just training. You can train animals to do all kinds of stuff. And this is where one of the places where the dancing bear fallacy comes from, and where I give it its name, is, you know, that there, look, there's a dancing bear. There used to be a dancing bear that would perform during intermission at Winter Garden in Manhattan. I saw it all the time. And he was wonderful. He was incredible, but he was a bear. He was a trained animal, and it's no different from training your dog to play Frisbee. Your dog doesn't know what a Frisbee is, and your dog doesn't know that it is a conceptually idealized goal in your part to train your dog to play Frisbee. Your dog is just playing catch, and your dog is playing catch because you have the kind of dog that would don't make good trainees for playing Frisbee. All of these arguments are completely bogus. The dancing bear fallacy was a real problem at freetheanimal.com because people kind of got stuck on the idea of dancing and bears rather than really understanding the argument. And the argument is that human beings are radically distinct. There's a bright line distinction between human conceptual, volitionally conceptual behavior and the kind of behavior of in animals. And the fact that an animal can be trained to mimic certain human behaviors does not make an animal in any way human or rational, actual, or really volitional. Animals do have will, but a dog, for instance, could not choose to train you to play with a Frisbee. Your dog, if you give your dog a Frisbee and you haven't trained him to play Frisbee, your dog is going to chew it up, and chances are it's going to chew it, eat it, and leave it in little pieces in the backyard, because that's what dogs do. If you don't train them, dogs are incapable of conceptualization. They can't look at a Frisbee and say, you know what, a flat disc like that, that kind of, this is probably going to sail through the air really, really well. I mean, we could take an ordinary flat disc and it'll sell real well, but look at the curves on that thing. That thing is going to exhibit the same kind of characteristics that we associate with a wing in flight, and therefore it's probably going to sail really, really well. Let's take it outside and throw it around a little bit. I mean, I can't throw, but you can. I'll show you how. You throw it, I'll catch it. Your dog is not going to do anything at all like that because your dog cannot conceive of any of that. And even when you train your dog to play Frisbee, your dog is never going to think twice about what it is that makes the Frisbee sail through the air and why it is that you can aim it in particular directions and put it right where it needs to be for your dog to jump up and catch it. That's never going to happen. Never going to happen. And in the same respect, a monkey learning, you know, 200 new signals, this is all just signaling behavior. And the monkey is just exhibiting trained animal behavior. That's all that's happening. And, you know, monkeys are very bright among mammals, and they are capable of pattern matching. Your dog is capable of pattern matching. And so I'm talking to you, Rob. Stop asking questions. There's someone down here chatting at me, and it's distracting. The animal can engage in pattern matching. The animal can learn signaling just exactly like your dog can learn signaling. So your dog can learn that when you hold your hand high, it means sit. That's not father tongue. That's not rational speech. That's not what human beings are doing. And in consequence, it's an error to conflate these behaviors. It is completely erroneous to conflate these behaviors. And so worrying about dancing, worrying about bears, that wasn't really the problem. The problem was conflating human behavior with animal behavior, and the two are not at all alike. I mean, in certain respects, human behavior is like animal behavior. When you cuddle with your child and when you cuddle with a puppy, it's equally cuddly. And in that circumstance, not just a child but a baby, in that circumstance, what the other party, the baby or the dog, is experiencing is essentially the same thing. You know conceptually what's going on, but an infant doesn't know what's going on. It just knows it's taking comfort from the cuddling. Rob, go away. I'm not doing this for you, so feel free to go away. All of these errors, we now know we know nothing, your behavior is determined, dancing bears are just like us. These are all instances of the reductionist fallacy in the social sciences. And reductionism is common, very common, in this kind of stuff. The arguments are all completely self-consuming in the sense that to say that we know nothing, you necessarily know that one something, and now you have to explain how you know that and nothing else. That's completely absurd, obviously. And again, no one is going to operate on this behavior. No one is going to suddenly conclude that they're blind in all regards and can't successfully do anything. The determinist fallacy we've talked about again and again and again with respect to watchword determinism, but every one of these determinist arguments is fallacious. And if you insist that there's no possible way that I could ever change my circumstances, I can't change my weight, I can't change my job, I can't make more money, I can't do better in my relationships, because all that's determined arguments, it can't possibly be the case. And you can't say that you have been persuaded of this without being capable of being persuaded. And you can't persuade me of your position unless you're willing to concede that I can be persuaded. And so the determinist argument says that I simultaneously can and cannot be persuaded. And that can't be the case. That cannot possibly be the case. And in consequence, there really are no adherents for any of these positions. There's no one who actually behaves this way. There's no one who believes this in their actual existential behavior. There's no one who actually acts like this. And in consequence, there's no reason for you to believe it because they don't believe it either. There's no reason for you to go along with these things. And so when you see these arguments on the internet, in the newspaper, in a magazine, in some kind of scholarly journal or whatever, when you see these arguments, they may seem hugely persuasive to you. And remember, this is one of the purposes of Father Tongue, is to make enormously persuasive arguments. But you have to remember when you're reading them, you have to remember first that they're necessarily bogus arguments, and second that the people who are making those arguments don't actually believe them anyway. And that's one of the things you can do if you're, you know, one-on-one having a discussion with someone and they're saying, oh, well, no, all human behavior is determined. There's no such thing as free will. Free will is an illusion. Ask about the luggage tags. Do you have tags on your luggage? You travel from time to time. Do you put tags on your luggage? Put your name and address and phone number on your luggage tags? Why the hell do you do that? If all behavior is baked in the cake luggage, which why would that happen if we're all just robots? But second, you anticipate that if your luggage gets lost, that someone can recover it and return it to you. Why would you make that assumption if human behavior is not changeable? If people are not capable of recognizing errors and correcting them? And if everything is necessarily baked in the cake from the birth of the universe or from some other specious cause that you want to name, why would you do anything, you yourself do anything, which again is negating the theory? Why would you pursue any of these things? And in fact, there are no adherents to these beliefs, but affecting to believe in them, pretending, making believe that you believe in them, leads to fatalism. Fatalism is the argument that everything is fated, nothing can be changed, and you can catch people, you know, exhibiting this point of view when they're exceptionally depressed. But in fact, affecting to pretend to believe that your mind is inefficacious to change your circumstances will lead to a kind of philosophical fatalism that will come to govern your life. It will ruin your life. And that's a huge mistake, obviously, because clearly you can change your circumstances. There's no possible doubt. And no one really doubts that you can change your circumstances. But you can't tell yourself the same lie over and over and over again without affecting your future performance. And all three of these categories of bogus arguments will be enormously damaging to your performance going forward. They will rob you of your efficacy. They will rob you of your potency. And this is a huge mistake. It's an enormous mistake. And I'm bringing this up, covering all this to this point, because of this same kind of fatalistic argument with respect to our political circumstances. I was delighted by the events Tuesday in Wisconsin and California. I really love to see people standing up for their own rights, their own lives, their own property. And I'm delighted to see okay, I just got rid of Rob. He was a nuisance. I'm sorry to be delayed like this, but it just was a heckler. And he's free to be a heckler. Just let him go heckle somebody else. I don't want to waste time on him. I'm delighted to see these kind of changes taking place. I'm delighted to see people getting involved like this. And the counter argument to this would be that, and I'm worried about it too. I wrote a post about it yesterday, that merely being involved in government is a hugely risky proposition, because power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Government is a cloying addiction. And I fear for the people who are expressing this involvement, but I fear for us too, because government is where Marxists come from. Government is where thugs, tyrants come from. And getting involved in that sort of process could easily turn these people into the next gang of thugs. And my argument to them was, as you know, as long as they pursue nothing but a philosophy of cutting government, they are not at risk of that kind of peril, and we're not at risk from them becoming thugs. And the counter argument that people would make to that is that there's no possible way that can work out, and I just don't believe it. I wrote Man Alive because I believe that people can change their behavior, they can change the way they think, and I want to help them change the way they think. But this is all about evangelizing egoism. And I really see people learn to understand the idea of self-adoration the way that I defend it, and learn to practice it, learn to practice that kind of egoism. And frankly, my style of egoist is indomitable, is completely, no one can dominate you if you understand the self for what it is. No one can dominate you, because you will recognize the behavior as soon as you see it. You will, exactly like we're talking about with these three bogus arguments about human nature. They're not about human nature, and they're not about helping you understand yourself, and they're not about helping you understand the universe. They are about dominating you. They are about whipping you into shape to get you to surrender your own values, your own interests, to get you to sacrifice your values so that other people can steal them from you. That's what they're for. And I'm not saying that the people making the arguments necessarily understand that, because as far as I'm concerned, most people are equally fooled. They are all fooled by this crap. They're all sucked in by it. And, you know, they simultaneously believe it and don't believe it, which is cognitive dissonance. This is how you get to a place where you become a persistent, indefatigable advocate of error, is by simultaneously affecting to believe two different things. And so you say simultaneously, all behavior is determined, free will is an illusion, and turn that damn stereo down. Well, the two can't possibly coexist. And if you try to make them coexist in your mind, those two kind of ideas, number one, you can't change your behavior. Number two, you can change your behavior. If you're trying to sustain both of those ideas in your mind at the same time, then you are constantly going to be at war with yourself. And this, again, is another way of robbing yourself of your future efficacy. Even if you don't actually arrive at fatalism, you will necessarily waste a ton of your mental energy fighting with yourself. And that's the purpose of those kind of bogus arguments. The purpose of those kind of bogus arguments is to rob you of your efficacy, to deprive you of the ability to act in your own behalf, to defend your own interests, to serve your own purposes. And it works. It really, really works. And so is the solution electoral politics in the long run? No, it isn't. The solution is egoism. But can electoral politics help us move in that direction? I'm hoping that it can, because I want to see this change happen peacefully. I desperately want to see this change happen peacefully. I do not want the kind of conflagration that we're apt to see in Europe later this year, or that we see all the time in other parts of the world. I don't want to see that happen here. And if it's going to happen peacefully, it's going to happen through the electoral process. It will have to. This is the only way we have of making these kind of changes peacefully, is through the ballot box. And I am delighted to see people doing this, and I want to help them get better at it. I want to help them learn how to do this better, how to be more competent, more capable at removing these onerous burdens from our lives, and simultaneously help them to avoid the kind of cloying temptations that government entails. And the way to go about doing that, obviously, is to understand yourself in the way that you really are. Chapter 2 of Man Alive is a very good place to begin. Frankly, my advice to people, that I know there are people who are doing this already, that there are people who have read Man Alive twice, three times, several times, and get something different out of it every time. And that was my intent. That was my purpose. That was one of the things that I was doing. And the reason that that's going to work that way is because it is a new way of thinking. You have never thought this way before. You've never considered the universe in the way that I see it. And so it will take a while for it all, our arguments. And we now know nothing. All behavior is determined. Dancing bears are just like us. Thinking about those as you see them in real life, when they show up on the internet or in the newspaper, the magazine, in some kind of scholarly journal, when you see them, to think about what the claim is that it's being made. And the reason that I wanted to isolate these three examples is because they will show up again and again and again. And if you remember them, every time you see some item like this making one of these claims, if you remember this discussion that we're having today, you will be that much better defended against those kind of errors. I made this for my wife. I should make this available at selfadoration.com. It's a bumper sticker sized poster. So she's got tape it up on the top of a computer monitor. It says, "Pursuing my values is my only job." Pursuing my values is my only job. And if you remember that, just those few words, just remember those words, burn them into your brain. Pursuing my values is my only job. If you remember those few words, you will be able to make the appropriate choices when you're at an inflection point, when someone is actively trying to get you to betray your values, or to spit on your nature, or to deny the efficacy of your mind, or to insist that you are incapable of acting in your own behalf. When you are at that kind of inflection point, if you remember, pursuing my values is my only job, you will know how to defend yourself. You'll know what to do. My name is Greg Swan. I wrote a book called Man Alive, A Survival Manual for the Human Mind. You can find it at selfadoration.com, along with a whole lot of other stuff about these topics. I talk about this almost every day. I will be doing my regular movie of the week on Sunday, I think. I may do it through Spreecast, or I may do it separately. I haven't decided yet. I thank you so much for giving me your time and your attention, and I am grateful to Rob for wasting so much of his life on me, because now I'm in his brain forever. I will be in his brain for the rest of his life. He'll constantly be fighting with me until he goes and reads the book and finds out how to defend his own mind. And that's what you should do too. So anyway, bless you. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for your attention. I am very, very grateful. You have yourself a wonderful day today and